Stavi made a face.
He has a secret name, she said. An Imas name.
Story's brow knitted as she looked down upon the drooling toddler playing in the dirt. She twisted round on the stone she was sitting on.
But we can't get it, can we? I mean, he doesn't know it, that name. How can he? He can't talk. Not true. I heard him talk. He says, blah, 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 blah. And that's all he says. That doesn't sound Imas to me.
Stavi tugged at the knots in her hair, unmindful of the midges swarming round her head.
But I heard father talking.
Story's head snapped up, eyes accusing.
When? You snuck off to be with him, without me. I knew it.
Stavi grinned.
You were squatting over a hole. Besides, he wasn't talking to me. He was talking to himself. Praying, maybe. Father never prays. Who else would he be talking to, except some five-headed Imas god? Really? Which head? What? Which head was he talking to? How should I know? The one listening. It had ears on stalks, and they turned, and then it popped out one eye and swallowed it.
Story leapt to her feet.
So it could look out its hole. Only way gods know how to aim.
Story squealed with laughter. The dirt-faced runt looked up from his playing, eyes wide, and then he smiled and said,
Bla la bla la bla la. That's the god's name. But which head?
Stavi asked.
The one with poop in his ears, of course. Listen, if we can really find out his secret name, we can curse him forever and ever. That's what I was saying. What kind of curses? Good ones. He can only walk on his hands. He starts every sentence with bla la bla la bla la. Even when he's 20 years old. As old as that, and even older. That's pretty old. That's grey-haired old. Let's think of more curses.
Sitting oblivious on the ground, the son of Onos Tulan and Hetan made curling patterns in the soft dust with one finger. 4 squiggles in one particular pattern, trying again and again to get it just right. It was getting dark. Shadows walked out from stones. The shadows were part of the pattern. The Imas possessed no written language. Something far more ancient was buried deep within them. It was liquid. It was stain on skin. It was the magic of shadows cast by nothing, nothing real. It was the gift of discord, the deception of unnatural things slipped into a natural world. It was cause in search of effect. When the sun was gone from the sky, fire rose in its stead, and fire was the maker of shadows, revealer of secrets. The child had a secret name, and it was written in elusive, impermanent games of light and dark, a thing that could flicker into and out of existence in the dancing of flames, or, as now, at the moment of the sun's death, with the air itself crumbling to grainy dust. Absi Kir. A name gifted by a father struck with unexpected hope, long after the death of hopeful youth. It was a name striving for faith, when faith had departed the man's world. It whispered like a chill wind, rising up from the cavern of the worm. Absi Kir. Its breath was dry, plucking at eyes that had forgotten how to close. Born of love, it was a cry of desperation. Patterns in the dirt, fast sinking into formless gloom. Absi Kir. Autumn Promise. Story held up a hand, cutting short a list of curses grown past breathless, and cocked her head.
Some news, she said.
Nodding, Stavi reached down and snatched up the boy. He struggled, tilting his head back until it pressed hard against her chest. She blew down, stirring the hair atop his slightly elongated head, and he instantly settled.
Excited voices. Not happy excited. No,
Stavi agreed, turning to look in the direction of the camp, just beyond a sweep of tilted rock outcroppings. The glow of fires was rising beneath a layer of wood smoke.
We should get back.
Hetan cursed under her breath. The girls had kidnapped their half-brother yet again, and no one had seen their escape. When they were out of her sight, the vast pit of her solitude opened its maw beneath her, and she could feel herself tumbling and spinning as she fell, and fell. So much darkness, so little hope that the plunge would end in a merciful snap of bones, the sudden bliss of oblivion. Without her children, she was nothing. Sitting motionless, wandering inside her skull, dull-eyed and weaving like a hoof-kicked dog. Nose sniffing, claws scratching, but there was no way out. Without her children, the future vanished, a moth plunging into the fire. She blinked motes from her eyes, hands drawn together and thumbnails picking at the scabs and oozing slices left behind by the last assault on the ends of her fingers, the tender skin round the nails. Frozen in place, sunken, in endless retreat. Another bowl of rust leaf, Durhang? A resin bud of Dabayang? Daras beer? Too much effort, every one of them. If she sat perfectly still, time would vanish. Until the girls brought him back. Until she saw the twins pretending to smile, but skittish and worried behind their eyes. And he would squirm in a girl's arms, reaching for Hetan, who would see those strangely large, wide hands with their stubby fingers, clutching, straining, and a howl would rise within her, lifting out of that black maw, blazing like a skystone returning to the sky. She would take him into a suffocating embrace, desperate sparks igniting within her, forcing her into animation. Strings on the ends of those pudgy fingers, plucking her to life. And she howled and she howled. Heavy footsteps rushed past the entrance to the tent. Voices, a few shouts. A runner had entered the camp. The word was delivered, and the word was dead. How could imagination hope to achieve the wonders of reality? The broken, deathly landscape stretched out on all sides, but the vista was shrinking as the day's light faded. Yet more than darkness embraced the transformation. Domes of cracked bedrock appeared, skinned in lichen and moss. Shin-high trees with thick, twisted boles, branches fluttering with the last of the autumn leaves, like blackened layers of peeled skin. Bitter arctic wind rushing down from the northwest to herald winter's eager arrival. Kafal and Setok ran through this new world. The frigid air bit in their lungs. Yet it was richer and sweeter than anything they had breathed in their own realm, their own time. How to describe the noise of 100,000 wolves running across the land? It filled Kafal's skull with the immensity of an ocean. Padded footfalls delivered a pitch and rhythm unlike that of spaded hoofs. The brush of fur as shoulders rubbed was a seething whisper. The heat rising from bodies was thick as mist, the animal smell overwhelming. The smell of a world without cities, forges, charcoal burners, without battlefields, trenches filled with waste, without human sweat and perfumes, the smoke of rust leaf and Durhang, the dust of frantic destruction. Wolves. Before humans waged war upon them, before the millennia-long campaign of slaughter, before the lands emptied. He could almost see them. Every sense but sight was alive with the creatures, and he and Setok were carried along on the ghostly tide. All that was gone had returned, all this history seeking a home. They would not find it among his people. He did not understand why Setok was leading them to the Bargast. He could hear her singing, but the words she used belonged to some other language. The tone was strangely fraught, as if warring forces were bound together. Curiosity and wariness, congress and terror. He could almost see the glint of bestial eyes as they watched the first band of humans from a distance. Did these two-legged strangers promise friendship, cooperation, a recognition of brother and sisterhood? Yes, to all of that. But this was no family at peace. This was a thing writhing with deceit, betrayal, black malice, and cruelty. The wolves were innocents. They stood no chance. Flee the Bargast, please, I beg you. But his pleading rang hollow even to Kafal. He needed them, he needed this swift passage. Night had fallen. A wind was rising to tear at the torches and hearth fires in the Sanan camp. Rain spat with stinging fury and lightning ignited the horizon. Eyes gleamed, iron licked the darkness. The gods were showing him what was coming. And he would not get there in time, because, as has ever been known, the Bargast gods were bastards. Heart thudding with anticipation, Sethand Gryll slipped out from the light of the wind-whipped fires. He had watched the children and their furtive flight into the shattered hills northeast of the camp when the sun was still a hand's breadth above the horizon. This had been his singular responsibility for weeks now, spying on the horrid little creatures, all leading to this moment, this reward. He had killed the boy's dog, and now he would kill the boy, plunging his knife into his belly with a hand over his mouth to stifle the shrieks, a large rock to crush the skull and destroy the face, because no one welcomed the face of a dead child, especially one frozen in twisted pain. He had no desire to look upon the half-lidded eyes that saw nothing, that had gone flat with the soul's absence. No, he would destroy the thing utterly, and then fling it into a defile. The twins were destined for something far more elaborate. He'd break their legs, then tie their hands. He'd blood them both, but not cruelly, for Sethand was not one of those who hungered to rape, not women, not children. But he would give them his seed to carry to the gods. This night of murder, it was for the Bargast, the righting of wrongs, the end of the usurper's line and the eradication of Hetan's shame. Onos Tulan was not of the clans of the White Face. He was not even Bargast. No matter, word had come. Onos Tulan was dead, murdered by Bakal, who had broken his own arm with the force of the knife thrust he had driven into the war leader's heart. A power struggle was coming. Sethand Gryll well knew that Sakara had decided on the Baran war chief Maral Eb. But to Sethand's eyes, and to those of many others among the Sanan, Bakal would make a surer claim, and that was one Sethand would back. More blood to be spilled before things settled out. Most were agreed on that. Sakara the Vile, her idiot husband, Stolman, Maral Eb and his vicious brothers, the new war leader would be Sanan. No other clan was as powerful, after all, not even the Baran. It would have to be quick, all of it. The cursed Akrinai army was on its way. Sethand Gryll padded through the darkness. The brats should be on their way back by now. Even they weren't stupid enough to stay out once the sun set, what with both half-starved wolves and Akrinai marauders on the hunt. So, where were they? From the camp behind him, someone shrieked. It had begun. Three women entered the tent, and Hetan knew them all. She watched them advance on her, and suddenly everything became perfectly clear, perfectly understandable. Mysteries flitted away like veils of smoke on the wind. "Now I join you, husband." She reached for her knife and found only the sheath at her hip. Her eyes snapped to the flat stone on which sat the remnants of her last meal, and there waited the knife, and Hetan lunged for the weapon. She did not reach it in time. A knee slammed into her jaw, whipped her head round, blood spinning in threads. Hands snagged her wrists, dragged her round and pushed her to the ground. Fists pummeled her face. Flares of light exploded behind her eyes. Stunned, suddenly too weak to struggle, she felt herself rolled onto her stomach. Rawhide bound her arms behind her. Fingers snarled a fist's worth of hair and lifted her head up. Balamit's foul breath whispered across her cheek.
"No easy way for you, whore. No, it's hobbling for Hetan. And what's so different about that? You'd rut with a dog if it knew how to kiss. May you live 100 years.
She was thrown onto her back and then lifted up from behind, Javis's nails digging deep into Hetan's armpits. Hegger, burly, miserable Hegger, swung the hatchet down. Hetan shrieked as the front half of her right foot was chopped off. The leg jumped, spraying blood. She tried to pull the other one away, but a crack of the hatchet's iron ball against her kneecap numbed the leg. The hatchet swung down again. The pain rushed in a black flood. Balamit giggled. Hetan passed out. Kryn, whose niece had married a Gadra warrior and was swollen with child, watched as Sakara's bitch dogs dragged Hetan out from the tent. The whore was unconscious. Her stumped feet trailed wet streaks that seemed to flare as lightning flashed in the night. They brought her to the nearest hearth fire. Little Yedin was tending to the flat blade, and it was pale hot when she lifted it from the coals. Meat sizzled and popped as the blade was pushed against Hetan's left foot. The woman's body jerked, her eyes staring open in shock. A second shriek shattered the air. 9-year-old Yedin stared, and then at an impatient snap from one of the bitches, she flipped the blade and seared Hetan's other foot. Kryn hurried forward, scowling at the way Hetan's eyes had rolled up, head lolling.
"Wake her up, Hagga! I'm fast!"
His sister grinned, still holding the bloodied hatchet.
"Your son?"
Kryn looked away, disgusted. He was barely half her age. Then he jerked a nod.
"Tonight's the night for it," he said. "Widow's gift,"
Hegga cried in glee. Javis brought over a gourd of water and threw its contents into Hetan's bruised face. She sputtered, coughed. Kryn advanced on her, mindful and delighted at how many people had gathered and at how other men were arguing their place.
"Keep her hands tied," he said, "for the first dozen or so. After that, there won't be any need."
It was true. No Bargast woman resisted by that point. And in a few days, she'd dropped to her hands and knees at a glance, backside upthrust and ready.
"Might be 24, someone in the crowd observed. "Hetan was a warrior, after all."
Hegga stepped up and kicked Hetan in the ribs. Spittle flew from the widow's lips as she snarled and said,
"What's a warrior without a weapon? Bah! She'll be licking her lips after 5 or so, you'll see."
Kryn said nothing, nor did anyone else. The warriors knew their own, after all. Hegga was an idiot to think Hetan would break so easily.
"I remember you, Hegga. My sister, too fat to fight. And who was the one licking her lips 5 times a day? Oh, we see where your hate lives. Gods, I am giving my son to this thing. Well, just for one night, and I'll give him my own knife with leave to use it. No one will miss you, Hegga, and no one will call out my boy either."
The wind was howling. A storm had found them on this fateful night. He could hear rain in the distance. Guy ropes quivered and hummed. Hide walls thumped and rippled. Bargast warriors were pouring into the encampment as if the wild drumming had summoned them. And Kryn caught word that Maral Eb had arrived, along with the Sanan warriors Tul had taken with him. Bakal among them, slayer, liberator of all the Bargast. Who would forget this night? Who would forget, too, that it was Kryn, firstborn son of Humbral Tar's own uncle, who was the first to fuck Hetan? The thought hardened him. He stood above her, waiting until her wild eyes slanted across his own. And when that fevered gaze stuttered and then returned to lock with his, Kryn smiled. He saw the shock and then the hurt that was betrayal, and he nodded.
"Allies, Hetan? You lost them all. When you proclaimed him as your husband. When you championed your father's madness."
Hegga pushed back in.
"Where are your children, Hetan? Shall I tell you? Dead and cold in the darkness."
Kryn backhanded her across the face.
"Your time with her is over, widow. Go, run and hide in your hut."
Hegga wiped blood from her lips, and then, eyes flashing, she wheeled, shouting,
"Bavalt, son of Kryn, tonight you are mine."
Kryn almost sent a knife her way as she pushed through the crowd.
"A knife, son, long before she wraps round you, long before you sink into that spider's hole."
As the significance of Hegger's words worked through, there was laughter, and Kryn was stung by the contempt he heard all round him. He looked down at Hetan. She was still staring up at him, eyes unwavering. Shame flooded through him, stealing his hardness fast as a mother's kiss.
"Don't think you can watch," he said in a growl, crouching to pull her onto her stomach.
As he tugged down her leathers, excitement returned. awakened by anger as much as anything else. Oh, and triumph, for many men among the Sanan had looked upon her with lust and desire, and they were even now arguing their turn with her.
But I am the first. I will make you forget Onos Tulan. I will remind you of the manhood of the Bargast.
He knelt, pushing with his knees to splay wide her legs.
Lift up to me, whore. Show them all how you accept your fate.
Pain was a distant roar. Something cold and sharp now filled her skull, fixed like spears to her eyes, and every face she had looked upon since awakening once more had pierced her like lightning, arcing in from her eyes, igniting her brain. Faces, those expressions and all that they revealed, they were burned upon her soul now. She had played with Hegar's younger sister. They had been so close. But that woman was somewhere in the crowd now, flat-eyed, walled off. Javis had spun a fine horse blanket as a wedding gift, and Hetan remembered her bright, proud smile when Hetan singled her out in giving public thanks. Balamit, daughter of a shoulder woman, had been her keeper on the night of first blood, when Hetan was barely 12 years old. She'd sat awake, holding her hand, until sleep finally took the child, now a woman. Yedin often played with the twins.
Husband, I have betrayed you. In my misery, in my pathetic self-pity, I knew this was coming. How could it not? My children, I have abandoned them. They killed them, husband. They killed our children.
Lift up to meet me, whore.
Kryn, I used to laugh at your hunger for me, sick as it was. Does my father's ghost wait for you, Kryn? Does he witness this and what you demand of me? Does he understand my shame? Kryn now punishes me. He is only the first, but no matter how many there are, the punishment will never be enough. Now I understand the mind of a hobbled woman. I understand.
And she lifted up to meet him. The wretches saw him before he saw them, and they saw, too, the heavy knife in his hand. None would deny that the twins were clever, nasty creatures, in the manner of newborn snakes, and so when they spun round and fled, Sathand Gryll was not surprised. But one of them was burdened with a child, and that child was now screaming. Oh, they might silence him in the only way possible, a suffocating hand over his mouth and nose, thus sparing Sathand the blood on his own hands. And he waited for that as he plunged in pursuit, but the shrieks went on. He could run them down, and so he would, eventually. He was sure they knew that they were already dead. Well, if they would make it a game, he would play. One last gesture of childhood before he took childhood away. Would they squeal when he caught them? An interesting question. If not immediately, then later, yes. Later, they would squeal indeed. Scrabbling sounds ahead, at the slumped end of a rock-walled defile. And Sathand lumbered forward. Yes, there was one of them, with that boy in her arms, trying to climb up the scree. The boulder very nearly killed him, dropping down to hammer into his shoulder. He howled in pain, stumbled, caught the flash of the other twin up on the edge of the wall to his left.
You rotted piece of dung, he snarled. You will pay for that.
No longer a game. He would give them hurt for hurt, and then more. He would make them regret such stupid attempts. Ahead, the girl with the boy had given up trying to climb the fan of sand and gravel, and had instead dropped down and to the right, vanishing into a crevasse. A moment later, the other girl darted in after her sister. The whole thing had been an act, a trap. So clever, weren't they? Mind blackening with fury, he bolted after them. Setok was tugging at his arms.
Kafal, get up!
It was too late. He was seeing all there was to see, cursed by his own gods. Could he close hands about their necks, one by one, and choke the life from them? He vowed he would. His beloved sister, he had screamed as the hatchet chopped down. He had fallen to his knees when Kryn stepped up to her, and now he sought to claw out his own eyes, although the visions behind them proved indifferent to the damage done to them. Blood ran with tears. He would dig and dig until never again would he look upon the world, but it seemed that blindness would forever elude him. He watched Kryn rape his bloodkin. He heard the exhortations from the hundreds of warriors gathered round. He saw Bakal, gaunt and his eyes luminous, stumble into view, saw the man's horror as all the blood left his face, saw as the great slayer of Onos Tulan twisted round and fled, as if the war leader's ghostly hand was reaching for him. But it was just the rape of a hobbled woman, not even considered rape, in fact, just using. And Sathand Gryll, whom he had hunted beside in years past, was now hunting Stavi and Story, and Absi, who flailed in Stavi's arms as if in full awareness that this new world he had found was crumbling around him, that death was coming to take him before he could as much as taste it. And the boy was outraged, indignant, defiant, confused, terrified. Too much. No heart could withstand such visions. Setoc tugged at his arms, fought to keep his hands from his face.
"We must keep going. The wolves!
Hot take the wolves!"
"But he won't, you fool! He won't, but someone will! We must hurry, Cathal!"
His hand lashed out, caught her flush on the side of her head. The way her neck twisted round as she fell horrified him. Crying out, he crawled to her. The wolves were ghosts no longer. Blood clouded his eyes, dripped down in a mockery of tears.
"Setoc!"
She was still a child, still so young, so thin. The wolves howled, a chorus that deafened him, that drove him face first into the frozen dirt.
"Gods, my head! Stop! Stop, I beg you!"
If he screamed, he could not hear it. The beasts surged on all sides, closing in and in. They wanted him. They wanted his blood. From somewhere sounded a hunter's horn. Cathal leapt to his feet and ran from the world. When her sister passed the wailing boy over, Stavi clutched him to her chest. Story moved past her as they emerged from the fissure, grasping handfuls of tawny grasses to pull her way up the slope. This range of broken hills was narrow, an island of scoured limestone, and beyond it the land leveled out, flat, with nowhere to hide. She struggled up the tattered slope, gasping, the boy beating at her face with his tiny fists. They were going to die, she knew that now. Their life in all its loose joy, its perfect security, was suddenly gone. She longed for yesterday. She longed for the solid presence that was her adopted father. Once more the sight of his face, a face wide and weathered, with every feature exaggerated, oversized, his soft eyes that had only ever looked upon his children with love. Against the twins, it had seemed anger was impossible. Even disapproval wavered in a heartbeat. They had worked him like river clay, but they had known that beneath that clay there was a thing of iron, a thing of great power. He was a truth, resolute, unbreakable. They worked him because they knew that truth. Where was he now? What had happened to their mother? Why was Sathand Gryll hunting them? Why was he going to kill them? Story ran ahead, darting like a hare seeking cover, but there was none to be found. Ghoulish light painted the plain as the slashes etched the night. A cruel wind cut into their faces, and the mass of storm clouds blotted out the north sky. The sight of her sister's panic was like a knife in Stavi's chest. The world was as broken as the hills behind them, as broken as the vicious look in Sathan's eyes. She could have dropped that rock on his skull, she should have, but the thought of hurting him that much had horrified her. A part of her had wanted to believe that if she could manage to break his shoulder, he would give up, he would return to the camp. She knew now, bleak with despair, that such faith, that all of this could be so easily righted, was ridiculous. Her error in judgment was going to see them all killed. Hearing Sathand climb out of the fissure, Stavi cried out, running as fast as her legs could carry her. All at once the boy she held went quiet, and his arms wrapped tight round her neck, hands clutching her hair. He understood as well. Motionless as a doe in the grasses, not 10 paces from a hunting cat, his eyes wide, his breath panting and hot against the side of her neck. Tears streamed down her cheeks. He clutched her in the belief that she could protect him, that she could defend his life. But she knew she couldn't. She wasn't old enough. She wasn't fierce enough. She saw Story look back over a shoulder, saw her falter. Sathan's heavy footfalls were closing fast.
Go!
Stavi shrieked at her sister.
Just go!
Instead, Story bent down, scooped up a rock, and then sprinted back towards them.
Fierce sister! Brave sister! You fool!
They would die together, then. Stavi stumbled, fell to her knees, skinning them on the grasses. The burning pain loosed more tears, and everything blurred. The boy kicked himself free. Now he would run, fast as his short legs could take him. Instead, he stood and faced the charging warrior. The man was not a stranger, was he? No, he was kin, and in the shadow of a kinsman, there was safety. Stavi whispered,
"Not this time."
Sathand readied the knife in his hand, slowing now that the chase had come to an end. Nowhere for them to go, was there? His shoulder throbbed, and sharp bolts of pain shot out from his collarbone. He couldn't even lift that arm. She'd broken it. But the warrior's rage was fading.
They did not choose their parents. Who does? They're just unlucky. But that is the way of the world. Spawn of rulers inherit more than power. They inherit what happens when that power collapses. When a night of blood is unleashed and ambition floods black as locust ink.
He saw the stone gripped by one of the girls and nodded, pleased with her defiance. Only half her blood was Bargast, but it had awakened for this. He would have to take her down first.
What has happened?
Asked the girl standing beside the boy.
Sathand?
He bared his teeth. The right words now could take the fight out of them.
You are orphans, he said. Your pet.
The stone was a blur, catching him a glancing blow above his left eye. He cursed in pain and surprise, and then shook his head. Blood ran down into the eye, blinding it.
Spirits haunt you, he laughed. I've taken fewer wounds in battle, but one eye is enough. One working arm, too.
Sathand edged forward. The boy's eyes were wide, uncomprehending. He suddenly smiled and held out his arms. Sathand faltered.
Yes, I've taken you up and swung you in the air. I've tickled you until you shrieked, but that is done now.
He lifted the knife. The twins stared, unmoving. Would they protect the boy? He suspected they would. With teeth and nails, they would.
We are as we are. I am proud of you, he said. Proud of you all, but this must be.
The boy cried out as if in joy. Something slammed into his back. He staggered. The knife fell from his hand. Sathand frowned down at it. Why would he drop his weapon? Why was his strength draining away? On his knees, his lone eye finding the boy's level at last.
No, he's not looking at me. He's looking past me.
Confusion, a roar of something rushing deep in his skull. The warrior twisted round. The second arrow took him in the forehead, dead center, punching through the bone and ploughing into the brain. He never saw where it came from. Stavi sank down on watery legs. Her sister ran to their brother and snatched him up. He yelped in delight. In the greenish gloom, she could see the silhouette of a warrior astride a horse, 60 or more paces away. Something in that seemed unreal, and she struggled to track it down, and then gasped.
That arrow! Sathant was turning round, in motion, and yet 60 paces away, in this wind.
Her gaze fell to Sathant's corpse. She squinted at that arrow.
I've seen the like before.
Stavi moaned and crawled forward until she could close a hand about the arrow's shaft.
Father made this.
The rider was closing at a loose canter. Behind Stavi, her sister said,
That's not father. No, but look at the arrows.
Story set the boy down once more.
I see them. I see them, Staffy.
As the warrior drew closer, they could see that something was wrong with him and with his horse. The beast was too gaunt, its hide worn away in patches, its long stained teeth gleaming, the holes of its eyes lightless, lifeless. The rider was no better, but he held a horn bow, and within a saddle quiver a dozen or so of Onos Tulan's arrows were visible. A cowl was draped over the warrior's head, hiding what was left of his face and seemingly impervious to the gale. He let his horse slow to a walk and then halted it 10 paces away with a twitch of the reins. He seemed to study them, and Stavi caught an instant's blurred spark of a single eye. "The boy, yes," he said in Daru, but it was Daru with a Malazan accent. "But not you two." A chill crept over Stavi, and she felt her twin's hand slip into hers. "That," he said after a moment, "perhaps came out wrong. What I meant was, I see him in the boy, but not in you two."
"You knew him,"
Story accused. She pointed at the quiver.
"He made those. You stole them."
"He made them, yes, as a gift to me. But that was long ago, before you were born."
"Talk the younger," whispered Stavi.
"He spoke of me?"
That this warrior was undead did not matter. Both girls rushed forward, one to either side, to hug his withered thighs. At their touch, he might have flinched, but then he reached out with his hands, hesitated only to settle them on the heads of the girls, as they wept in relief. The son of Onos Tulan had not moved, but he watched, and he was still smiling. Setok's eyes fluttered open. The instant she moved her head, blinding agony lanced through her skull. She groaned. The night was luminous, the familiar green tinge of her own world. She could feel the wolves, no longer as solid beasts surrounding her, but as ghosts once more, ephemeral, hovering, pensive. A cold wind was blowing, lightning flashing to the north. Shivering, nauseated, Setok forced herself onto her knees. The dark plain spun round her. She tried to recall what had happened. Had she fallen?
"Kafal?"
As if in answer, Sunder rumbled. Blinking, she sat back on her haunches, looked round through bleared eyes. She found herself in the center of a ring of half-buried boulders, the jade glow from the south adding a green hint to their silvery sheen. Whatever patterns had been carved upon them had long since weathered away to the barest of indentations. But there was power here, old as anything on this plain, whispering sorrow to the empty land as the wind curled between the bleached humps. The wolf ghost slowly circled, as if drawn inward to this ring of stones and its mournful dirge. There was no sign of Kafal. Had he been lost in the realm of the beast hold? If so, then he was lost forever, falling back and back through the centuries, into times so ancient not a single human walked the world, where no bloodline was drawn to divide the hunter from the hunted, animals all. He would fall victim eventually, prey to some sharp-eyed predator. His death would be a lonely one, so lonely she suspected he would welcome it. Even the will of the wolves in their hundreds of thousands could barely brush the immensity of the lost hold's power. She huddled against the cold and the ache in her head. The rain arrived with the rage of hornets. Whipped by the wind and lashed by the rain, Kafal reached the edge of the encampment. Hearth fires flared and dipped beneath the deluge, but even in the fitful light he could see huddled crowds and the smaller makeshift camps of the Baran clustered round the edges. Figures hurried between the rows, hunched against the weather. He could see pickets here and there, haphazardly arranged with some of the posts abandoned. When lightning lit the scene, it seemed to seethe before his eyes. Somewhere in there was his sister, being used again and again. Warriors he had known all his life were pushing bloody paths into her, eager to join in the breaking of this once proud, beautiful, and powerful woman. Cathal and Tuol had spoken often of outlawing the tradition of hobbling, but too many resisted the casting away of traditions, even those as vicious as this one. He could not change what had happened, all the damage already done, but he could steal her away. He could save her the months, even years, of horror that awaited her. Cathal crouched, studying the Barghast camp. Swathed in furs, Balamut made her way back to her yurt. Such a night. Too many years bowing to that bitch, too many years stepping from her path, eyes downcast, as was demanded by Hetan's position as wife to the war leader. Well, the whore was paying the soul's coin for that now, wasn't she? Balamut ran through her mind once more the fateful moment when Hegar's hatchet descended. The way Hetan's whole body contorted in pain and shock, the deafening shriek cutting like a knife in the air. Some people lived as if privilege was something they were born to, as if everyone else was a lesser being, as if their domination was a natural truth. Well, there were other truths in nature, weren't there? The gathering of the pack could bring down the fiercest wolf. Balamut grinned as the rain spat icy against her face. Not just a pack, but a thousand of her kind. The pushed down, the murky shapes that made up the common crowd, the ignored subjects of contempt. No, this was a worldly lesson, was it not? And sweetest truth of all,
we are far from finished.
Maral Ebb was a fool. Just another one of those superior bastards who thought their damned farts could buy a crown. Bakal was a much better choice, a Senan for one, and the Baran were no match for her tribe. To think they could just step into the stirrup when they'd not even had a hand in killing Onos Tulan. Why, it was... A huge shape stepped out from between two tarp-covered dung piles, bowled into her hard enough to make her stagger. The figure reached out to right her, even as she hissed a curse, and then the hand clutched tighter and snatched her close. A knife blade sank between her ribs, the point slicing her heart in half. Blinking in the sudden darkness, Balamut's legs gave out beneath her, and she fell to the mud. Her killer left her there without a backward glance. Javis finally rose from her place close to the fire, as the flames had at last guttered out beneath the rain. Her bones ached terribly when the weather turned cold, and the injustice of that galled her. She was barely into her fifth decade, after all. But now that she was among the powerful, she could demand a ritual of healing to scour clean the rot in her joints, and she would have to pay nothing, nothing at all. Sakara had promised, and Sakara knew the importance of favoring her allies. Life would be good once again, as it had been in her youth. She could take as many men as she wanted. She could take for herself the finest furs to stay warm at night. She might even buy a Duras slave or two to work oils into her skin and make her supple once more. She'd heard they could take away stretch marks and make sagging breasts taut. They could smooth the wrinkles from her face, even the deep bird track between her brows, where had gathered a lifetime of injustice and anger. Seeing the last of the coals blacken at her feet, she turned away. Two warriors stood before her. Baran, one of them Kashat, Maral Ebb's brother. The other warrior she did not recognize.
"What do you want?"
Javis demanded in sudden fear.
"Just this," Kashat said, and he lashed out.
She caught the gleam of an etched blade, a sting against her throat, and suddenly heat poured down the front of her chest. The ache in her bones vanished, and after a time the knot in her brow slowly relaxed, making her face, as the rain kissed it, almost young again. Little Yedin crouched beside the body of Hegar, staring at the pool of blood that still steamed even as raindrops pounded its surface. The nightmare would not end, and she could still feel the heat of the iron paddle she'd used to cauterize Hetan's feet. It pulsed like fever up her arms, but could not reach the sickly chill wrapped about her heart. So terrible a thing, and Hegar had made her do it, because Hegar had a way of making people do things, especially young people. She'd show them the dangerous thing in her eyes, and nothing more would be needed. But Hetan had never been mean, had never been anything but nice, gentle, always ready with a wink. And Stavian's story, too, always making Yedin laugh, the acts they put on, all their crazy ideas and plans. The world ahead was suddenly dark, unknowable. And look here, someone had gone and killed Hegger. The dangerous thing in her eyes hadn't been enough. But then, what was? What those men did to Hetan. A hand grabbed the back of her collar and she was lifted from the ground. A stranger's face stared at her own. From one side, another voice spoke.
She won't remember much of this, Sagal.
One of Hegger's imps.
Even so.
Sagal set her down and she tottered on wobbly legs. He put his huge hands against the sides of her head. Their eyes met and Yedin saw a darkness come to life there, a dangerous thing. Sagal snapped her neck, dropped the body onto Hegger's.
Find Befka. One more to go this night. For you.
What of Sakara and Stolmen?
Sagal grinned.
Kashat and me, we're saving the best for last. Now go, Korit.
The warrior nodded.
And then I get my turn with Hetan.
She's worth it, the way she squirms in the mud.
Once Strahl had left, Bakal sat alone in his yurt. His wife would not return this night, he knew, and he admitted he would be not too upset if she did not return at all. Amazing that surprises could come to a marriage after so many years. The skein of rules was torn apart this night, strands winging on the black wind. A thousand possibilities awakened in people's souls, long-buried feuds clawed up out of the ground and knives dripped. A warrior could look into a friend's eyes and see a stranger, could look into a mate's eyes and see the flare of wicked desires. She wanted another man, but Bakal was in the way. That man wanted her in turn, but his wife was in the way. Bakal's wife had stood before him, a half-smile playing on her face, a living thing pleased to deliver pain, if pain was possible, which he'd found, to his own bemusement, it was not. The moment she'd realized that, her visage had transformed into hatred. When she left, she was holding her knife. Between her and her new lover, a woman would die tonight. Would he stop them? He had not yet decided. Nothing raged inside him. Nothing smoldered an instant's breath from bursting into flame. Even the effort of thinking exhausted him.
Blood runs down,
an ancient saying among the Bargast. When a ruler is murdered, 1,000 blades are drawn, and the weak become savage.
We are in our night of madness. An enemy marches to find us, and we are locked in a frenzy of senseless slaughter, killing our own.
He could hear faint screams cutting through the howling wind. The image of his wife's face, so ugly in its wants, rose before him.
No, I will not let it be.
He rose, cast about until he found his coin-scaled hauberk. If he was too late to save the woman, he would kill both his wife and her lover. An act, he decided, devoid of madness.
Find him! Exhorted Sakara. His brothers are out, killing our allies. Maral Eb is alone.
He is not, said Stolman. On this night, that would be insane.
She glared at him, huge in his armor, a heavy hook knife in one gauntleted hand, a miserable look on his stolid face.
Tell him you would discuss the alliance of the Gadra clan. Just find a reason. Once you cut his throat...
His brothers will hunt me down and kill me. Listen, woman, you told me you wanted Maral Eb to command the warriors.
I did not expect him to move on us this very night. Hegger is dead. Javis is nowhere to be found, nor is Balamit. Don't you understand what's happening?
It seems you don't. If they're all dead, then we are next.
He'll not dare touch us. I have 100 slayers. I have spies in every clan. No, he still needs us.
He won't think that way when I try and kill him.
Don't just try, husband. Do it and be sure of it. Leave his fool brothers to me.
The rain was hammering down on the thick hides humped over the sapling frame of the yurt's ceiling. Someone shrieked nearby. Stallman's face was ashen.
Spirit below, he doesn't even need the paint tonight. Must I do this too? Are you worth anything to me?
Sakara, I stand here ready to give up my life to protect you. Once this night is done, the madness will end. We need only survive.
I'm not interested in just surviving.
He stared at her, as if seeing her for the first time. Something in that look, so strange on his face, sent a tendril of disquiet through Sakara. She stepped closer, set a hand on his scaled chest.
I understand, husband. Know that I value what you are doing. I just don't think it's necessary, that's all. Please, do this for me. Find Maral Ebb, and if you see that he is surrounded by bodyguards, then return here. We will know that he fears for his life. We will have struck our first blow against him without even raising a hand.
He sighed, turned to the entrance. The wind gusted round him when he pushed aside the flap and stepped outside. Sakara backed away from the chill. A moment later, she heard a heavy thump, and then something rolled into the tent wall before sliding to the ground. Heart in her throat, hands to her mouth, Sakara froze. Sagal was the first to enter the yurt. His brother Kashat came in behind him, a tulwar in one hand, the blade slick with watery blood.
Sakara the Vile, said Sagal, smiling. 'Tis a cruel night. I'm glad he's dead, she replied, nodding to the dripping blade. Useless, a burden upon my every ambition.
Ambitions, yes, muttered Kashat, looking round. You've done yourself well, I see.
I have many, many friends. We know, said Sagal. We've met with some of them this night. Maral Ebb needs me. He needs what I know. My spies, my assassins. As a widow, I am no threat to you, any of you. Your brother shall be war leader, and I will make certain he is unassailed.
Sagal shrugged.
We'll think on it.
Licking her lips, she nodded.
Tell Maral Ebb I will come to him tomorrow. We have much to discuss. There will be rivals. What of Bakal? Have you thought of him? I can lead you straight to his yurt. Let me get my cloak.
No need for that, Sagal said. Bakal is no longer a threat. A shame, the slayer of Onos Tulan dying so suddenly.
He glanced across at Kashat.
Choked on something, wasn't it?
Something,
Kashat replied. Sakara said,
there will be others, ones that I know about that you don't, among the Sanan and even my own people.
Yes, yes, you'll sell them all, woman.
I serve the war leader.
We'll see, won't we?
At that, Sagal swung round, left the yurt. Kashat paused to clean her husband's blood from his tulwar, using a priceless banner hanging from the ridgepole. He paused at the entrance, grinned at her, and then followed his brother. Sakara staggered back a step, sank down onto a travel chest. Shivering gripped her, shook her, rattled her very bones. She struggled to swallow, but her mouth and throat were too dry. She laced together her hands on her lap, but they slipped free of each other. She could not take hold of anything. The wind buffeted the hide walls, cold air lancing in from the entrance flap, which had not settled properly back into place. She should get up, fix that. Instead, she sat, shaking, fighting her slippery hands.
Stallman,
she whispered.
Husband, you left me, abandoned me. I almost,
she gasped,
I almost died.
She looked to where he had been standing, so big, so solid, and her eyes strayed to the banner and its horrid wet stain.
Ruined it,
she said in a mutter.
Ruined it.
She used to run it through her hands, that silk, through and through, like a stream of wealth that never wetted her palms. But no more. She would feel the crust of his blood, the dust speckling her hands.
He should have seen it coming. He should have.
Bakal had just cinched on his weapon belt while sitting down, struggling one-handed with the clasp, when the two Baran warriors rushed in. He surged upright, the hook blade hissed free of its scabbard, and he caught the heavy slash of a descending tulwar. His lighter weapon's blade snapped clean just above the hilt. He leapt close and drove the jagged stub into the warrior's throat. Blood poured onto his hand. The other was coming round the brazier. Bakal backstepped from the warrior drowning in his own blood. He had nothing with which to defend himself.
Wife, it seems you win.
A shape loomed behind the Baran, who was readying his tulwar for a decapitating cut. Hook blades licked both sides of his throat. The brazier hissed and crackled as spatters struck it. Reeling, the Baran stumbled to one side, fell over the armor chest, leaving one twitching foot visible from where stood Bakal. Gasping, his arm in agony, he swung his gaze to the newcomer.
Kafal, I dreamed it, the priest said, face twisting. Your hand, your knife, into his heart.
Did you dream as well, Kafal, who delivered that blow?
The burly warrior sagged, stepped clumsily away from the entrance, his eyes dropping to the weapons in his hands.
I've come for her.
Not tonight.
The hook blade snapped back into fighting position, and Kafal made to advance on him, but Bakal raised his hand.
I will help you, but not tonight. She fell unconscious. 2 dozen men, maybe more, had used her. Any more, and she would die, and they won't let that happen. The women have her, Kafal. They will tend to her, cackling like starlings. You know of what I speak. Until her flesh is healed, you cannot get into that hut. Those women will tear you to pieces. My wife went there first, before her other tasks. To see, to join in. She laughed at me, at my horror. Kafal, she laughed!
The priest's visage was furrowed in cuts. He had been clawing at his own face, Bakal realized.
Your dreams,
he whispered, eyes widening.
You saw. I saw. Kafal, but it's not over. They don't know that. None of them know that. Our gods are howling in terror.
He fixed wild eyes on Bakal.
Did they think they could get away with that? Did they forget what he was, where he came from? He will take them into his hands and he will crush them.
He bared his teeth.
And I will stand back. Do you hear me? I will stand back, Bakal, and do nothing.
Your sister.
He started as if Bakal had slapped him.
Yes, I will wait. You can't hide here, Kafal. More of Maral Eb's assassins will come for me. This night is almost spent,
the priest said.
The madness is already blowing itself out. Find your allies, Bakal. Gather them close.
Come back in 3 days, Bakal said. I will help you. We'll get her out, away. But, Kafal, you must know.
The man flinched.
It will be too late,
he said in a wretched tone.
Yes, I know. I know.
Go with the last of the night, Bakal said.
He went to find one of his older weapons and then paused, stared down at the two corpses crumpled on the floor.
I must do something now. One last thing.
He lifted bleak eyes to the priest.
It seems the madness is not quite blown out.
The rider emerged from the night with a child before him on the saddle. 2 young girls flanked the horse, staggering with exhaustion. As the storm's ragged tail scudded south, taking the rain with it, Setok watched the stranger's approach. The man, she knew, was a revenant, an undead soldier of the Reaper. But seated as she was in the center of this ring of stones, she knew she had nothing to fear. This ancient power defied the hunger for blood. It was, she knew now, made for that very purpose. Against elder gods in their ceaseless thirst, it was a sanctuary, a and was and would ever remain so. He drew rein just outside the ring, as she knew he must. Setoc rose to her feet, eyeing the girls, dressed as Bargast, but neither was purely of that blood. Twins, eyes dull with fading shock, and a kind of fearless calm rising in its place. A small boy, she saw, was smiling at her. The revenant lifted the child with one hand, to which the boy clung like a Balkando ape, and carefully set him down on the ground. "Take them," the revenant said to Setoc, and the undead eyes he fixed upon her blazed, one human and wrinkled in death, the other bright and amber, the eye of a wolf. Setoc gasped.
"You are not the Reaper's servant."
"It's my flaw," he replied.
"What is?"
"Cursed by indecision. Take them, camp within the circle. Wait."
"For what?"
The rider collected the reins and drew the beast round. "For his war to end, Destriant." He hesitated and then said, "We leave when I return." She watched him ride away, westward, as if fleeing the rising sun. The two girls closed on the boy and each took one of his hands. They edged warily closer. Setoc sighed.
"You are Hetan's get?"
Nods.
"I am a friend of your uncle, Kafal. No," she added wearily, "I do not know where he has gone. Perhaps," she added, thinking of the revenant's last words, "he will return. For now, come closer. I will make a fire. You can eat and then rest."
Once inside the circle, the boy pulled loose from his sister's hands and walked to the southwestern edge of the ring, where he stared at seemingly nothing on the dark horizon, and then he began a strange rhythmic babbling, almost a song. At the sound, Setoc shivered. When she turned to the twins, she saw that they had found her bedroll and were now wrapped together in its folds, fast asleep.
"Must have been a long walk."
The carrion eaters had picked away the last strip of meat. Jackals had chewed on the bones, but found even their powerful jaws could not crush them sufficiently to swallow the splinters down. Nor could they grind the ends, as was their habit. In the end, they left the fragments scattered in the trampled grasses. Besides, there was more to be found, not only in this place, but in numerous others across the plain. It was proving a season for fly-swarmed muzzles and full bellies. After a few days, all the scavengers had left, abandoning the scene to the sun, wind, and stars. The blades of grasses prickled free of dried-up blood, the roots thickened on enriched soil, and insects crawled like the teeth of the earth, devouring all they could. On a night with a storm raging to the east and south, a night when foreign gods howled and ghost wolves raced like a tidal flood across an unseen landscape, when the campfires of armies whipped and stuttered, and the jackals ran first one way and then another, as the stench of spilled blood brushed them on all sides, the buried valley with its sprawl of boulders and bones and its ash heap of burnt remains began to move here and there, fragments drawing together, forming into ribs, phalanges, leg bones, vertebrae. As if imbued with iron seeking a lodestone, they slid and rolled in fits and starts. The wind that had begun in the southeast now rushed over the land, a gale like 100,000 voices rising, ever rising. Grasses whipped into frenzied motion, dust swirled up and round and spun, filling the air with grit. In the still cloudless sky overhead, the slashes seemed to pulse and waver, as if seen through waves of heat. Bones clattered together. From beneath the mass of boulders and crumpled armor in the valley, pieces of rotting flesh pulled free, tendons writhing like serpents, ligaments wriggling like worms, climbing free and crawling closer to the heap of bones, which were edging into a pattern, reforming a recognizable shape, a skeleton, loosely assembled, but the bones were neither Akrini nor Bargast. These were thicker, with high ridges where heavy muscles once gripped tight. The skull that had been crushed was now complete once more, battered and scorched. It sat motionless, upper teeth on the ground, until the mandible clicked up against it, and then pushed beneath it, tilting the skull back, until the jaw's hinges slipped into their joints. Flesh and desiccated skin, random clumps of filthy hair, ligaments gripped long bones, ends fusing to join them into limbs. Twisted coils of muscle found tendons and were pulled flat as the tendons grew taut. An arm was knitted together, scores of finger bones clumping at the end of the wrist. Rotting meat bound the vertebrae into a serpentine curl. Ribs sank into indentations on the sides of the sternum and lifted it clear of the ground. When the slashes were gouging the horizon to the southeast, and the wind was dying in fitful gusts, a body lay on the grasses. Fragments of skin joined to enclose it, each seam knitting like a scar. Strands of hair found root on the pate of the skull. As the wind fell away, there was the distant sound of singing, an old woman's rough, enfeebled voice, and in the music of that song there were fists closed into tight knots, there was muscle building to terrible violence, and faces immune to the sun's heat and life's pity. The voice ensorcelled, drawing power from the land's deepest memories. Dawn crept to the horizon, bled color into the sky, and a Tlani Mas rose from the ground. Walked with slow, unsteady strides to the fire-annealed flint sword left lying close to the bargast pyre. A withered but oversized hand reached down and closed about the grip, lifting the weapon clear. Onos Tulan faced southeast and then set out. He had a people to kill.